Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. And I see Senator Johnson here, so I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 304.
And she's the only one.
Madam Chair and member of the committee.
I don't know where the rest of my committee is.
For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent District 16. And I want to start by saying, for as long as I've served in the legislature, I have tried hard to stay away from DHS and DHS issues. And one found me this summer. I ended up, and I'll give you a little history because it's germane to this bill, and then we'll come to the point of the bill. I was asked, as many of us were, by the governor to go to a gathering of foster parents and read a proclamation thanking them for their service and basically encouraging others to consider being foster parents. I thought to myself, how hard is this going to be? I'll go read the proclamation, have a cookie and a cup of coffee, and that'll be that. As I arrived, I started having foster parents want to talk to me. And I would say, sure, let's talk, but it was always, no, we got to go out in the hall. The caseworker sees me talking to you, a legislator, I'm going to be in trouble. And that metastasized into my full-on engagement in an adoption that, from my perspective, went very, very wrong. This was a family who had successfully fostered children and had successfully adopted out of the DHS system. They were interested in adopting a child that had lived with them more than half of his life. A mixed race child. All of this was happening in Columbia County, which doesn't have much demographic diversity. The family was very eager to keep this child. As I observed the family unit, it was a loving unit. This sweet little boy just buried in his mother's neck, and the family all obviously head over heels in love with him. As the story matured, and I'm giving the Cliff Notes version, it pretty soon became clear that a number of things were happening. First of all, the foster family that had taken care of this child for as long as they had were largely excluded from the deliberations. And it began to be clear to me that the foster family, the custodial foster family that was known to DHS, was being systematically kept away from the proceedings as conversations were emerging about adoption. And finally, it began to become clear to me that maybe the agency had a problem with a mixed race child staying in predominantly white Columbia County. This bill grew out of that experience. I am pleased to report to you today that not only is the precious little boy going to stay in Columbia County, but so is his natural sibling and one other child that this family sought to adopt, who the caseworker, the child's lawyer, everybody associated with that case said this child has no more moves left in her. She can't be shuffled to yet another foster home. And so here was a known commodity to DHS, willing to take siblings and willing to take this last little girl who had had such a difficult, numerous stays. I wrote the bill largely out of anger, and I will admit that I was so frustrated by the fact scenario that I had in front of me that we wrote a bill that is, by my own admission, not a very good bill. But it forces a conversation. I think that it is a shame that a legislator has to drop a bill in order to engage in a conversation, and I readily admit that I'm one in a long series of legislators. I'm looking right now at a foster parent and one, Senator Shields, who has had issues with the agency over time. But I think that I join that long line of legislators who are saying we've got to do this better. I had been approached by Mr. Livingston, former Judge Livingston, who now works for the court, saying that the bill, the way that we had it crafted, might put an undue burden on the courts. And he will have recommendations about this bill. I had been approached by the, and I forgive me, I can't remember their new name, Youth, Justice, and Rights, used to be the Juvenile Rights Project.
Youth Rights and Justice.
And they have recommendations for the bill. And so I anticipate that after I leave this witness table that you will hear from others talking about the deficiencies in the bill. I embrace those. I welcome the suggestions to make the bill better. The things that I was trying to get at were that long-term foster parents, parents that have had kids in their homes for multiple years, in some cases, as in my case, more than half of the child's life, that are able to adopt, have a track record of successful adoption, should not be treated as strangers. This case got so bad that it was reported to me that the foster parents were directed to go have cheesecake pictures taken of the child so that the child could be shopped around. This is a kid, not a kitten. And I was horrified at what happened. And so this is probably not the way to bring forward legislation, and I apologize for taking the committee's time to do it. But I want to just add my name to that list of legislators who is simply saying, I want to be part of a conversation to find a methodology in this agency that does these kinds of placements more transparently and uses the best interests of the child as the North Star. In one of the cases of these three kids that are going to the family in Columbia County, they were hunting for relatives that the child had never known. This was already a child that had tremendous issues being in so many foster placements, but hunting for possible parents that the child had never met, pulling this child out of a situation where the child had clearly, by my observation, bonded. And so I know that we have swung the pendulum back and forth. We have said that consanguinity trumps everything. We've swung back the other way. I think that the legislature and the agency, if we can find a pathway to work together, have got to find a better way for our kids. It seems to me that to be in a home for a long period of time establishes that bond, particularly when the children are young. And as I snarled at the caseworkers and snarled at senior management at DHS on more than one occasion, that child doesn't care what color the person that's reading them Goodnight Moon is. They just care that those are their mother's loving arms putting them to bed. Those ought to be the kinds of guideposts that we use to find homes for these kids who have been, in some cases, abused, neglected, and shuttled around. We should take no pride in the fact that we have a system that in so many instances seems so broken. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I offer myself up to those that have gone before me with much more expertise, perhaps not as much passion as I picked up over the summer watching this engagement with the family and DHS, but I offer myself up to that growing list of legislators who are saying there has to be a better path. And it is with that spirit that I bring you 304. DHS came to visit me early this morning. I invited them to come down and find fault with the bill. Because if, in fact, the legislature is the forum in which we have these discussions, let's all use our best wisdom and our best thoughts to build a good bill that ultimately benefits those kids, and we can look them in the eye and say, we did our best for you. That's the spirit of the bill.
Thank you so much. Is there questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
I appreciate you bringing this. Some of us have been engaged in this for a very long time. But I would also say that we purposely, and a few years ago, made it clear that being a foster parent didn't put you necessarily in the first chair for adoption as we're looking for family members and other things. But I do think you bring up a valuable point as far as time has to be a factor in this. There's no question about that. So, Madam Chair, I look forward to further discussions on this topic, but quite honestly, you know, in my mind, relative placement is always first if indeed we can find that and make it viable. But when you're dealing with a young kid and it's been years, that creates an entirely different dynamic.
Madam Chair, if I may respond. I, first of all, as a newbie to this issue, I honor the fact that so many of you have worked so hard on it. And I acknowledge openly that I come to this party late. There are many others in the building with much more experience. The point that I am making is that I wouldn't want to give a short-term foster placement the ability to trump family members. This bill was designed for a long-term foster placement where the consanguineous relatives were unknown to the child. So instead of staying with a foster family where affectionate bonds had formed, the possibility that the agency would go out and look for others just by the dint of that blood connection, but the child didn't know them. Somewhere there is a balance here, and I would be the last person to say just because a child passed through the doors of a foster home that should give those foster parents any trump over family. conversely, a long-term placement and attachment bonds need to be honored, even at the expense, in my opinion, of a relative not being given the first placement opportunity.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
I just want to echo that. I mean, I think most of you know that we had some children come to live with us who we had hoped would be permanent foster or possibly adoptive. And, you know, part of the situation with them ended up being that DHS found out that two of the children had other half-siblings who were then adults but who had very complicated, had themselves been foster children and adopted, and they were starting to consider whether these kids should be placed with these older siblings. And it made zero sense. I mean, these are young adults with no experience in parenting, but because they were blood relatives. And I don't blame DHS. I understand the reason to try to reach out and make sure, because children want that connection. They want to know where they're from, and I get that. I think that what I hear Senator Johnson saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, Senator, is that there can't be a knee-jerk reaction, a knee-jerk plan that fits every child, and we just have to always keep in mind that what we have to focus on first and foremost is what's best for each individual child. Yes, getting relatives engaged when it's possible, great. No, doing it automatically and making that the default for every child without considering individual circumstances, that's what needs to be addressed. Am I hearing you correctly, Senator?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, yes, you are. And I know that many task forces have gone before and failed. But I think given the self-imposed deadlines that we now have in this process, I would have brought you perhaps a more fully developed bill. Not long after my fact scenario unfolded, Judge Fetke in Multnomah County had just the opposite. It was African-American parents and two white children. I don't know the details of that case, and so much of these discussions end up shrouded in a kind of mist of secrecy. That's another thing that I was quite concerned about in finding out that the long-term foster parents were shut out of the deliberations about an adoption at the very end. Some of this stuff, I think, can be changed in rules. Some of it may need legislative, I'm going to say partnership with the agency, because I know that each one of us, and I'll dare say it's every 90 of all 90 of us, have had that call that starts out, I'm calling you about DHS and the kids. And your heart just sinks. First of all, you know it's going to be a story with at least six sides. You know it's going to take days of work on your part or your staff's work to try to sort it out. There are all kinds of privacy issues, and I understand and respect those. But at the end of the day, we are talking about forever homes for kids. And these are kids sometimes at terribly impressionable ages. And I think in many instances, we've let them down. We've let them down by bureaucracy. We've let them down by expressing our predisposition to how this system ought to work in statute. We've let them down all sorts of ways. And somewhere out there, there's got to be that balance. I will acknowledge that I think DHS staff in the field are tremendously overworked. And I shudder at the thought of one call. These guys, just as soon as they pick up the phone, they're getting the next call. So it's a compounding series of problems. And again, I acknowledge my latecomer status to the debate.
Well, Senator Shields has a comment.
Oh, well, thank you. This is an opportunity for me to bring to this committee's attention, as well as Senator Johnson and those in the committee, that Representative Thompson and I were scratching our heads about this. How do we make foster parents actually have more standing in these issues than just the person walking down the street on the sidewalk, which is really what they have at this particular juncture? And so we introduced Senate Bill 570, which would allow foster parents to organize. I'm not going to move that bill forward this session because I do think it's a little premature, but I think getting to the notion of how do we retain good foster parents and give them the rights that they need to be the best advocates they can for the kids is what the heart of that issue is. And I just wanted to bring it to the attention of the committee. That's Senate Bill 570. It's not ready for prime time now, but I think we need to strengthen the ability of foster parents to advocate for themselves, and that's what the bill is about.
Thank you.
We are looking at some major rehaul of DHS, and I can't remember the bill number.
That's up today.
Is it up today?
Are you talking about 21 or 450?
Yeah.
21.
That's the long-term care.
Right.
Long-term care.
450 is
the streamlining services.
Right.
Madam Chair, this is certainly not the forum to work this bill, and again, I bring you an incomplete bill, but in order to make it under the deadline and at least self-identify as someone interested in this issue, I asked for your indulgence to hear it. You have. I appreciate your courtesy. There are others coming behind me that will have suggestions about the bill. Whether this bill moves or not is of less concern to me than we begin in some forum a dialogue to say, let's get the relevant people, that DOJ, the judges, the agency, the right folks around the table to think about maybe we need for future legislative sessions a more comprehensive redo of this process. Again, I'm respectful of the fact others have gone before me. I'm just now joining the group of people that say there's got to be a better way to do this.
I'm glad that you brought the bill forward. Obviously, it will need amendments. If it was to move, we don't have time to even get it out of the system because of the time it would take for us to draft the amendments and then get the fiscal and the revenue, et cetera. So
then you may elect, Madam Chair, not to take the committee's time to hear this. And what I would do is to invite amendments from those that are interested. I largely had people come in and complain and tell me what was wrong with the bill. I did not have a generous outpouring of suggestions about what kind of language would make it better. If you wanted to, under the aegis of this committee, suggest some kind of an interim work group, I would happily participate in such a work group. But I don't know that you need to take time to work the bill today, because I readily admit the bill is not ready for prime time.
Okay. Well, there are three people that I would like to hear that want to address this issue. And so we'll hear them, but know that we won't be moving the bill. But we definitely want to look at some suggestions on how we can make the system respond to the way the system is now.
Well, I thank you and the members of the committee for your courtesy.
Right. With that, thank you, Senator Johnson. I'll call up Michael Livingston, Jerry Weybrandt, and Mark McKechnie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And maybe we can have some interim group to work on this stuff.
Yeah, that would be
And we don't need to take a whole lot of time. We have a lot of bills that we need to get through. Yeah. So because we're not going to move the bill, I think it would be very important to see your vision on how maybe we can address this issue long term.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm the Juvenile Law Staff Counsel for the Judicial Department. Before that, I had the honor of serving 2.5 years as a Marion County Juvenile Court referee and pro tem judge, and before that with the Department of Justice, doing a lot of work in the area of juvenile law. I will be brief, Madam Chair. We ask foster parents in this state to do two very contradictory things. We ask them to take wounded children, in effect, into their homes and love them and make a home for them, and then to support case plans that return them to parents when the parents have made the changes they need to make. In the case that Senator Johnson has described, that commitment was over a longer term than that. And when I spoke with Senator Johnson and her aide, we had a long and fruitful good discussion about this. This bill does not address the case that she has described, which is the longer term placement and what kind of decision making principles should be applied in that case. The Judicial Department, as I told her when we met, is more than happy to participate in discussions to get at this issue in a meaningful and appropriate way. I've submitted testimony in written form and electronic form identifying the specific problems with the bill. Identifying those problems in the bill does not mean there's a problem outside, does not mean there's not a problem to resolve outside it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chairman is Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz in the committee. And my name is Jerry Weybrandt. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency for Department of Human Services. I'll also be brief. I wanted to highlight a couple of sections in the bill that we have concern about. One of them is the bill removes the court's authority to review a placement and non-related persons. And that means that they wouldn't be having a best interest finding, and the best interest finding is related to the least restrictive, most family-like setting, is important to us around our 4E funding. Also want to point out that the court order, as this would be, would complicate our ability to comply with ASFA, that's the Safe Family Act that was passed. And then lastly, this bill requires Hartman and the court to give preference to permanency to non-related foster parents. Federal law requires the states giving, to give or consider giving placement preference to an adult relative or not related caregivers whenever possible. That said, we've actually met with Senator Johnson. We've expressed a willingness to sit down and talk about the concerns she has about the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you would be willing to serve on an interim work group?
Chair Anderson, absolutely we would.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Mark McKechnie, Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We also had conversations with Senator Johnson and others about the issues underlying this bill, and there were some themes that emerged. One is that while we, the legislature passed Senate Bill 414 in 2007, it was part of a bipartisan package that did place a greater emphasis on finding and placing children with relatives. But there was an important piece of that was that it left discretion to take into account all of the different variables that could occur in different cases. It was not a mandate. It was not forcing DHS to always place with relatives. What we're concerned about right now is that DHS's adoption rules went too far in creating a mandate that relatives always be considered above current caretakers, even very long-term foster placements. And what was lost was the focus on the best interests of the children involved and who their adoptive parents in their forever home should be. So one solution that we feel is necessary is to change DHS's administrative rules on the selection of adoptive homes to take away such a rigid hierarchy of placement preference and allow for a greater consideration of non-relatives who have long-term and very significant emotional bonds with children. The other issue that arose from some of the stories that I think led to the drafting of this bill is that the court can review cases, but the court doesn't have any specific authority when it comes to maintaining long-term foster placements. And the story alluded to earlier, the court was very concerned about DHS removing children from a very long-term placement, but the court had no authority to ultimately change the outcome. And that is also something that should be considered, that when a child is in a foster home for such a long period of time and emotional bonds are developed, they're considered current caretakers, or even in cases where the agency has already designated a foster home as a permanent foster placement, there should, in our opinion, be additional safeguards to prevent the severing and the movement of that, the severing of the relationship and the movement of the child out of that home. There should be more checks and balances. So we would approach the issues underlying this bill from those standpoints. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. This is a bad bill, but it's a great subject, and we know that. And Senator Shields and I have been talking. Jerry, we've been working on these things for a long time now, and I think this may tee up the next round of discussions that we're going to have. And you know, the other task force that's in 450 is hopefully going to point out the deficiencies that we have placed upon DHS as far as the workload that we put on caseworkers and things like that, that is incredibly overwhelming. And hopefully we can shine a bright light on those sorts of things in that task force. But I would suggest that, in fact, Senator Shields and I will probably have a conversation with Representative Krieger. I think you've met once or twice. And see where we go with this. But I do think this is a great subject for us to deal with in the interim. We don't need a bill for this. We can just do it. So I think this teed up something.
So who on this committee would like to serve on a work group during the interim? Who? Well, there's three of you, and I can only have two of you.
If you guys can, I mean, it's
okay.
As long as I know, I will. So I'll bail out of this one. Thank you.
Senator okay. Steiner Hayward will keep you informed.
You do that, Senator
so,
Cruz. Thank you.
Sandy, would you be willing to staff then the work group?
Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I could, Sandy, if you could talk to never mind, I will talk, we will figure out some House members that need to be a part of this as well.
And Senator Johnson, of course, you are, you know, you're able, you can serve on it too, but we have two members here, but we can't have a quorum. That's why I limited it to.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 304.
And 2007, we just, you know, then we kind of dropped the ball since then.
Yeah, we need to get some work sessions out of the way, so I need to open a work session on Senate Bill 21.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 21, you'll recall, was the bill that required DHS to develop a long-term care plan, specifies requirements for the development and implementation of the plan. It sunsets January 2, 2019. It has emergency clause. There was some discussion at our March 12th meeting. Group of the stakeholders and the department and a couple of our committee members met. What you have before you is an agreed-upon amendment, the dash threes, that everybody has come to an agreement with as far as the representations, those stakeholders included on it, the timelines that the plan is to be developed. And, Madam Chair, we have the fiscal and the revenue back on the dash three. There is no fiscal impact on the dash three, no revenue impact. If the committee so chooses, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference, which the committee may want to consider rescinding.
All right. Yes. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move adoption of the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 21, dated 3/19/13.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the dash three amendments, dated 3/19/13. Is there any discussion? All right.
Now you got to ask if there's any objection.
No. Yeah. Is there any objection? So adopted. Okay. Sandy, can you tell us what the...
I can do this. I can do this.
Okay. It says that there's no expenditure impact on Senate Bill.
I'll make the motion and it'll cover it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 21 as amended by the dash three amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request the Senate President to consider rescinding the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 21 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Request that the President rescind.
Request to the President that the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Well, clerk will call the roll and we'll find out.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monahan?
Aye. Our motion carries, and who was the carrier on this bill? Was there...
Madam Chair, I would suggest that we assign this to Senator Steiner Hayward, because if it does... You don't want it?
No, I'm fine with it. I just laugh.
Because if it goes the Ways and Means, you'd probably end up with it anyway.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do that, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Steiner Hayward will carry the bill. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 21 and open a public work session on Senate Bill 450.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 450 had a public hearing on March 21st. This establishes a 13-member task force on the delivery of human services. It specifies the membership, duties, powers, and functions. Has a sunset date. You have a dash three amendment in front of you that increases the membership from 13 to 20. And it also specifies the membership of that additional representation. You have a dash three amendment, Madam Chair. That does have a fiscal impact. This, too, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. And the dash threes have no revenue impact.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendment dated 3/21/13 to Senate Bill 450.
Senator Cruz moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 450. Is there any discussion? Is there any adoption? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 450 as amended by the necessary amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 450 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. With is there any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would just like to publicly thank a lot of people for their hard work in doing this. This is the kind of bill that could have been seen as threatening to people, and it was not intended in that way at all, and everybody understood it in the spirit that it was meant. And my staff member, Eamon McCleary, worked very, very closely with an awful lot of different agencies and interested groups to develop this in a way that everybody could come to agree with. So I really want to thank everybody who worked with Eamon, and I want to thank Eamon publicly for his incredible hard work in getting this pulled together. I'm really excited for the potential for this and look forward to working with everybody on it.
Great. Any other questions? Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and it's off to Ways and Means. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 450 and open a work session on Senate Bill 375.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 375 establishes the 10-member Stroke Care Committee in the Oregon Health Authority. We just had a hearing on this last week, April 2nd. It also directs the OHA director to appoint the members, provide the criteria for the committee, the terms of office, and develop a plan for the continuous improvement in the quality of stroke care. Madam Chair, we have a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 3 amendments and no revenue impact on the Dash 3 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 375 dated 3/26/13.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 375. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 375 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is it clear?
This one's
clean. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 375 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? As you know, this is fondly known as a gut and stuff, and is a stroke care committee established.
So it's kind of a gut and double stuff, I think. Yeah.
It's so confusing because it got stuffed into the wrong bill.
Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Motion carries.
I would recommend it's Bates' bill. Yeah. Let him carry it.
Senator Bates will carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 375 and open a work session on Senate Bill 728.
Again, Madam Chair, we had a public hearing on Senate Bill 728 last week, April 2nd. This, to coin your phrase, has a gut and stuff amendment on it, which establishes a 17-member state trauma advisory board, directs the Oregon Health Authority director to appoint the board members, specify the term of office and duties and responsibilities. Madam Chair, this has a fiscal impact, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference on the Dash 1 amendment, and there's a no revenue impact on the Dash 1.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment dated 3/19/13 to Senate Bill 728.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments dated 3/19 into Senate Bill 728. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 728 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 728 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I said as amended, with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hayward.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries, and this is on its way to Ways and Means. With that, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 725.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 725 is at the request of Senator Bates. It specifies terms for contracts entered into between the Oregon Health Authority and the Coordinated Care Organization. It modifies the financial requirements for the Coordinated Care Organizations to July 1, 2019 and July 1, 2024, declares an emergency effective on passage.
I'd like to call Gail, is it Medding or Heading? And Dean Andretta and Josh Bailey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gail Heading. I'm the director of CCO development for All Care Health Plan, which is a CCO serving Jackson, Josephine, and Curry counties in Southern Oregon. And thank you for the time today to speak with you. I'd like to request positive consideration for Senate Bill 725, creating a five-year contract for CCOs if and only if they meet certain quality references and metrics. It's not a guarantee, certainly, that a CCO would continue with the five-year contract, but only would suggest so after they have reached certain performance levels. Thus far in the CCO development process, a great deal of time has been dedicated to the application process, the transformation plans, which have just been submitted and approved, and four contract amendments in 8.5 months. So needless to say, a lot of administrative effort. We have some major programs to integrate into the CCOs in the next several months. The dental program moving forward July 1st, and then the non-emergent medical transportation bill as well. So lots of focus areas. The five-year contract would then allow us to focus on developing relationships with our county mental health partners, which are critical to the success of CCOs, our hospitals. We have significant work to do with them in defining and developing quality payment outcomes, which is a significant shift from how compensation is being derived today, as well as the work necessary on the health information exchange to allow data to be shared amongst providers. We continue to focus on developing our reserves, and our board is continually faced with decisions for long-term investment strategies. One such strategy that we have implemented immediately was the decision to hold three community advisory councils instead of the one. So we have a community advisory committee or council in each of our counties in our service area, and the long-term strategy around developing those relationships, putting those councils up, getting them functioning effectively would be greatly benefited by a multi-year contract. So I appreciate your favorable consideration for that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dean Andretta, and I am the Executive Director of the Willamette Valley Community Health and CCO in the Marion and Polk region, serving over 62,000 people right now. We started operation on August 1st and have spent hundreds of hours and lots of resources implementing the vision of healthcare transformation that was outlined in our contract with the Oregon Health Authority. A lot of new relationships have been developed, a lot of new people brought to the table, and this effort takes some time to a few more than months to really create what we want out of this, and what we want that the legislature, the taxpayers, the members, and other key stakeholders want out of this. So we also are encouraging your support to this, and appreciate the that this will bring a little bit of stability to us, a little bit of long-term planning approach to it, rather than month by month and year by year, and allow us to take advantage of a lot of the infrastructure that was developed around creating the CCO in our particular region. So with that, I would definitely appreciate your favorable view on this bill.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Josh Ballack, here on behalf of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. Just wanted to put on the record that we have been working with the Oregon Health Authority and the Governor's Office to try to be able to craft a bill that would be able to work. That's what the Dash 2 amendments are, that we're trying to make sure that these guys have some assurity, but also that if something does pop up, that there is flexibility for the legislature or the federal government makes changes, that they'll be able to be able to adapt as well, so that's not completely set in stone, but that, you know, this is a bill that will work. And again, this isn't a free ride for these guys. They do have to hit their quality metrics in order to get the next year as you kind of go through. So just wanted to get that on the record. So
as I read it, then, when you sign a contract, if you sign the contract, Oregon Health Authority cannot amend that contract more than once during a 12-month period.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, yes, but this does come with some stipulations that if there is changes to the federal government or if there's an emergency, that they would be able to.
And that's what the rest of the...
Correct, yes, that is correct, Chair.
All right, great. Golly, free ride.
All right.
Is the agency here? Do they... I know they're probably neutral on the bill. I don't see the agency here.
Madam Chair,
yes,
no one else has signed up to testify?
No.
Oh, interesting.
All right. So, with that, I will close the public hearing, and I would like to have this scheduled as a work session, Sandy. Is it on...
April 15th, Madam Chair.
April 15th, we'll be having a work session on this. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 725 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 802.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 802, the chief sponsor is the good Madam Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, provides for an institution or a program accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation of the American Dental Association does not need to name actively a licensed dentist as a dental director of a dental office or clinics owned or operated by the institution or the program.
Colleagues, this bill came forward when the community colleges called and said that the way the Board of Dentistry has, that if you have a dental assistant program or in a community college, that it must have a full-time physician on board, and that's difficult to find a dentist who could be on site a full-time, and the pay, of course, is not very lucrative, and so we thought that we would have a discussion about this, and I would like to call Lisa Rowley and John Wyckoff and Linda Gerber. Like John Wyckoff
isn't
here.
I'm here for John.
You're John today.
Wyckoff.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Smith. I'm the general counsel with the Oregon Community College Association, and John had to run out to do something else, so he asked if I would fill in. I will let Lisa and Linda give you the background information about this bill and why we need it, but I did want to put on the record that we have been working with the Oregon Dental Association to see if we could work on compromise language. We are still talking to them. I think we have made progress, and I'm hopeful that we can develop compromise language, but I would still like Linda and Lisa to give you a perspective of why we believe this bill is necessary.
And I think it's important for you to know that if the members of the committee so think that this is a good idea, that we may not have time to get the amendments through the process, but this would be going... shouldn't have a fiscal. It would be going over to the House where we could work with the Dental Association to make sure that we have a good bill.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do have a no fiscal impact and a no revenue impact on the original bill, unamended.
Because we just found out today.
Yes.
That there was possible amendments, and this has been on the books for a week, so It's too bad we didn't know this earlier, but that's all right.
Madam Chair, there was a dental conference last week, and everyone was at that conference, so it made it difficult to get the sign-off that we needed.
Thank you.
Chair Monica Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa J. Rowley, and I am a licensed dental hygienist and reside in Portland, Oregon. I'm the program director for the School of Dental Health Science at Pacific University. Pacific University is a private university with campuses in Forest Grove, Hillsborough, and Eugene. We offer a Bachelor of Science Dental Hygiene program. Our dental hygiene program is accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation, which operates under the auspices of the American Dental Association. I'm speaking to you today in support of Senate Bill 802. This bill would amend the Oregon Dental Practice Act so that allied dental education programs accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation, also known as CODA, would not be required to name an actively licensed dentist as their dental director. I believe that this is a very straightforward solution to a complex issue for our allied dental education programs in Oregon. I have been the program director for Pacific University's dental hygiene program for 7 years. Prior to coming to Pacific University, I was program director for a CODA-accredited dental assisting program and a CODA-accredited dental hygiene program in a community college setting for 9 years. CODA-accredited allied dental education programs throughout the United States may own and operate dental clinic facilities for the primary purpose of educating their students to perform dental procedures on patients. The patients who visit these dental clinics understand that their dental care is being provided by students under the supervision of faculty as part of an allied dental education program. The CODA accreditation standards require that allied dental education programs conduct a continuous, formal system of quality assurance for their patient care program. Patient safety must be closely monitored throughout the educational process, and the program must ensure that the need for students to complete specific clinical requirements does not adversely compromise the health and treatment of patients. These standards also require that allied dental education programs have a mechanism in place for reviewing patient records, identifying and correcting treatment deficiencies, and addressing patient complaints. Patients must be informed about the scope of services that can be provided by the program. Patients must be advised of their comprehensive treatment needs, and patients must be referred for procedures that cannot be provided by the program. It is common practice for CODA-accredited allied dental education programs to have more than one clinic dentist who teaches students and supervises patient care in their dental clinic facilities. These clinic dentists may be an employee of the program, or they may be volunteers. It is unusual for a CODA-accredited allied dental education program to have one dental director or employ one full-time dentist because the costs associated with this position would be prohibitive. And many of these dental clinic facilities operate in excess of 40 hours per week, so additional clinic dentists would still be needed to staff the additional clinic sessions. The CODA accreditation standards require that allied dental education programs identify the individuals, that is dentists, who assume responsibility for supervisory, diagnostic, consultative, and referral services and describe how these services are provided for the patients. The responsibilities of our clinic dentists include most of the responsibilities which are outlined in ORS 679020, Section 4A. However, these responsibilities generally do not include the retention of patient dental records or ensuring that each patient has a dentist of record. Patient dental records are retained by the Allied Dental Education Program. The individual clinic dentists do not have direct access to patient records, and they do not have the ability to provide patient records to a board of dentistry or to a patient. The CODA accreditation standards do require that all patients must be referred for procedures that cannot be provided by the program, but they do not specify that each patient must have a dentist of record. Many of the patients who seek dental care from an allied dental education program do so because they do not have a current dentist of record. We encourage all of our patients to secure a dentist of record outside of our program, and when they do, we forward a copy of their records to this dentist. Senate Bill 802 does not single out community colleges from other entities that may own or operate a dental clinic or dental office. This bill would apply to all CODA-accredited allied dental education programs in Oregon, whether they are offered by a community college, state college, or a private college like Pacific University. Senate Bill 802 would not remove the Oregon Board of Dentistry from the process of continuing public protection. The Oregon Board of Dentistry would continue to protect the public in the same way that they did prior to 2011 when they first became aware of the provision in the Oregon Dental Practice Act, which requires that a CODA-accredited allied dental education programs name an actively licensed dentist as their dental director. The Oregon Board of Dentistry can request patient records and the names of licensed dentists and dental hygienists who supervise the patient's care directly from the Allied Dental Education Program through the program director. Even if the program director is not licensed by the Oregon Board of Dentistry, the program director is still obligated to provide any information required by the board to assist them in conducting an investigation. I would like to address the letter that was sent to the program directors from the executive director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry and copied to your committee members. In this letter, dated March 26, 2013, the executive director indicates that the OBD has never opined that only one person had to be named as dental director. This subject was discussed extensively during two, and I apologize, not three, as I indicated in my testimony, two meetings that the program directors have had with the Board of Dentistry, and at each meeting we were told that we needed to name one dental director who would be responsible for all dental care that was provided in our dental clinic facilities, even if that person did not provide the care or had never even treated patients in our facilities. And to my knowledge, the Oregon Board of Dentistry has never opined that more than one person could be named as dental director. So this letter doesn't really help us because we don't even know that we can have multiple directors. This letter further states that the rationale for the dental director being named is so that the OBD can investigate any complaints made and patients can obtain their records with ease. I currently have seven different clinic dentists who are each contracted to work in my dental clinic facility on a part-time basis from January through May 2013. When our spring semester ends in May, these seven clinic dentists will no longer be employees of Pacific University. If a patient wants to obtain their records with ease, contacting the Board of Dentistry to obtain these seven names will not help the patient to obtain their records. As I mentioned previously, the individual clinic dentists who work with an allied dental education program do not have direct access to the patient records and do not have the ability to provide these records to the patient or to the Board of Dentistry. The Oregon Board of Dentistry and the patient would need to request this information directly from the Allied Dental Education Program through the program director, and the program director would be obligated to provide this information. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony today.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, my name is Linda Gerber, and I am president of Sylvania Campus Portland Community College. And I do appreciate this opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 208. PCC each year trains 85 dental professionals, including 45 dental assistants and 40 dental hygienists. Senate Bill 802 clarifies that accredited college and university dental education programs are not required to name a licensed dental director to oversee their dental education clinics. This proposed change impacts community colleges with our dental hygiene and dental assistant programs, as well as private and public Oregon colleges and universities. Not all of these colleges operate clinics that serve the public, but their students do study techniques in clinical education settings. These programs were notified in a letter by the Oregon Board of Dentistry Executive Director Patrick Bratz in May 2011 that the statute required the naming of a single actively licensed dental director. In August 2011, the 10 community college presidents with impacted programs sent a response to Mr. Bratz, and a copy of that is attached in my testimony. This bill does not change the requirement to have a licensed Oregon dentist overseeing procedures performed in clinics as a dentist of record. So dentists in our programs by law supervise, diagnose, consult, and provide referrals. Dental hygienists, of course, do not have the authority to diagnose. In fact, community colleges have not one, but many dentists who work in our education clinics who serve as dentist of record on the days they are working or volunteering, and who oversee students who are studying and learning DH and DA skills. Our accreditation standards, set by the Commission on Dental Accreditation of the American Dental Association, CODA, also require the involvement of dentists in clinical settings, and they address patient safety and standards of care. This bill does not change the way the stringent accreditation standards of our programs does not change in any way the stringent accreditation standards our programs must meet. In order to be successful when they complete their training, dental hygiene, dental assisting students must understand and abide by the different scopes of practices for dentists, dental hygienists, and dental assistants. And we have responsibility to teach them this, but also to emulate it in our clinical education settings.
The current statute, ORS 6790203E, already excludes accredited education programs from the requirement to have a licensed dentist own, operate, conduct, or maintain a dental practice office or clinic. So it makes no sense in the case of CODA accredited education programs to name a single licensed dentist as the dental director of our clinics, when we have, of our education clinics, when we have many dentists who supervise dental hygiene and dental assisting students and provide dental services in our clinics. For community colleges, this is a question of resources. We're able to offer dental hygiene and dental assisting education and clinical opportunities working with a committed group of dentists, some of whom are volunteers. Most of these dentists are not willing to take on the liability of being named the dental director of a clinical program, and we don't have the ability to add a position with this title in our programs because of cost constraints. As actively licensed dentists, the dentists who provide care in our clinics currently are accountable for the students and patients they oversee in the clinic. If a problem arises, they and their licenses are on the hook. This bill does not change that accountability. Community college dental hygiene and dental assisting programs are overseen by program directors and deans as required by CODA, the accrediting body. If a problem arises, these individuals have access to information about a particular dentist who was serving as a dentist of record on a particular day. Any inquiries from the Board of Dentistry could come to the college's dental program director or dean, and they could identify the dentist in question. This is far more appropriate in an education setting than is creating a new position of dental director. This bill does not prevent OBD from investigating a complaint through its regular process. So we urge your support of SB 802 so that we can continue our job of educating skilled dental hygienists and skilled dental assistants. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I mean, it makes perfect sense, but I think we need to hear from the Oregon Dental Association, so let's hear from them. No questions here. All right. George Okulich.
Chairman Sanderson, for the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. At this point, we're sort of neutral on Senate Bill 802. I did have some concerns that I brought to the community colleges last week, sat down with them. I think they were open and sympathetic to making some changes to the bill. You know, our fundamental concern has always been that this deals with changes to the ownership statute. Is we have long held a tradition where, you know, we don't interfere with a patient and a doctor. And over the years, we've sort of opened it up to say, you know, there are certain groups who can, you know, own a dental clinic, and, you know, they're the schools and the labor organizations, et cetera, local governments. You know, but in those cases, we've still said, for these organizations, you've got to name a dental director who is, you know, responsible for the, you know, treatment plan of dental patients, who's involved with diagnosis of conditions to deal with, as the statute says, the human oral cavity, kind of overall quality of patient care and the general practice of dentistry. So for us, it's important that we continue to keep that relationship with the patient. I mean, these are community college, you know, the ones that do public clinics. These are people who come on off the street, low income. These are students. And, you know, we're just concerned that, you know, they could be sort of operating without having sort of a dentist overseeing everything. So I think, like I said, we've talked to them about clarifying that a dentist of record needs to be named for these patients, that this dentist of record is responsible that day for the record keeping, for the patient quality of care, for the supervision. That way, that board of dentistry has someone that they can go and report to. They can go to the administration, and we can get those records. So I think if we can get that addressed, we'll be okay.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Okay, so they could have somebody who's not a dentist run the place as long as whoever the patient saw, there was on the record that that's who the patient saw.
So basically, we're not concerned with sort of the education piece, you know, and they can have a dental assistant or a dental hygienist can be a program administrator and kind of do the education curriculum. What our concern is when they do operate that clinic, that outside sort of clinic with that general public, and somebody comes in, that they actually will see a dentist of record that day, somebody who will have that record, who will be in charge of kind of making sure these safeguards are in place, and someone who, if there is a problem, if they call the Board of Dentistry and make a complaint, they can call the administration, they can say, here is the dentist of record who is responsible for keeping these things, all the files together, so that there's some accountability there.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Okay, I can understand. Okay, you have these dentists that are volunteering, maybe one day a week, maybe one day every 2 weeks, something like that. They obviously aren't running the clinic. So I guess if the college is running it without a dentist, but a dentist is the one actually seeing the patients, basically, as long as that's recorded, that patient X saw dentist Y, but the records are still kept by the college, is that going to be okay with you?
Yeah, as long as it's Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Cruz, I think the key thing is that dentist of record who has the knowledge of what are the things that they have to by their license keep in the file, that
right.
That they basically help maintain that file, put it together, and so when the board investigates, they can call and they can say, here's the dentist of record, here's the one who put this file together, here's to make sure that they have all the pieces included. And if for some reason there's not, if there was a mistake on a prescription, if there was, then that licensed dentist is responsible.
Okay.
Yeah, I worked with nursing students, particularly in immunization clinics, and I was the nurse, but then we also had the nursing instructor, and yes, records were kept for immunization, but we certainly didn't need I think they have nurses though, but to have a full-time nursing director for this, I mean, I can see using the nurses that are in whatever various clinics rather than having one designated dentist for the overall program. It just doesn't.
Yeah, and Chair Monis Anderson, and I think, you know, that goes to one of the issues. We don't care if a community college has 10 dentists or if they're all volunteer dentists. It really, how they set up that relationship, you know, if they have a list of 25 dentists, it really just goes to that one sort of clinical setting with that one patient, that there is sort of accountability, record keeping, and, you know, the things that a dentist is in charge of, you know, and a lot of these really aren't the sort of the dental hygiene, but more the dental assistants, where a dentist is supposed to be there to help do, you know.
Can I call, is it Karen? Karen, can you come up and describe how the record is taken care of now, or how you, yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the issue here is a difference in language between a dental director, which is how it's stated in the statute, and really the real issue is making sure that we have a dentist of record who the Board of Dentistry can follow up with if there is a complaint. So I think our compromise is that we ensure that our programs are maintaining the lists of the dentists of record who are seeing patients, and if a question comes up, then they would be required by law to provide that information to the Board of Dentistry so that there is that follow through when there's a complaint. Currently, the program accreditation standards require our programs to maintain all of those records about activities that occur in our clinics, and those are maintained by the dental hygiene and dental assisting programs. Am I saying that right, Lisa? Yes. And that is a required provision in our accreditation standards in order to maintain our accreditation. So there is a record-keeping component that lies with the program directors, and they have the ability, or under the compromise that we're talking about, they would be required to share information about patient files as required. But the sticking point is that the statute requires the naming of a actively licensed dental director, when really what we care about is dentist of record. The Board of Dentistry actually has a proposed rule that clarifies that the dentist who is seeing patients in our clinics can be considered the dentist of record, and that way we can maintain that list, and if a complaint comes, then we have a way to get that information back to the Board of Dentistry.
So you're pretty close.
I think we're pretty close.
Great. And could you have that to Sandy by the end of the day?
Today? Okay, give it to you right now.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah. One more question for George. Have we come close to satisfying the Portland Zoo on our dog bill yet?
Chair Austin, Senator Cruz, I think we're there.
Okay. Okay, good.
Well, great. Thank you.
Well, that's an important bill.
Thank you,
too,
both of you, very much, and for the panel. We will have this as work session on.
We're going to schedule it next week.
Yeah, it'll be next week as soon as we get the paperwork done. Tuesday the 16th, if we have the paperwork done. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 802. And colleagues, our agendas are going to be fairly full, and I want to try and do work sessions. I know that some of you are testifying on bills, so we'll try to work around your testimony, but would like you to know that we have lots of work sessions, and I'm so proud that we went through so many today. So with that, we're adjourned.